Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Nucleus Wealth Investment Insights. My name's Sam Kerr and I'm the Senior Financial Advisor at Nucleus Wealth, and I'll be the host of the show going forward. But more importantly, I'm joined today by the Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Damien, great to have you here as usual. How are you getting on today?
Not too bad. Thanks, Sam. Welcome aboard.
Thank you. So the topic and question for discussion today is, are supply chains broken? So obviously it's a relevant topic. On the agenda, we'll firstly look at two scenarios that drive the market. Then we'll have some in-depth insights into lumber volumes, prices, and capacity. Then we'll look at the shipping rates and the shipping traffic jam around the world and the implications of that. Next, we'll look at semiconductor production and utilization, and then new car sales and inventories. Then, as always, we'll discuss our investment implications for Australia and around the world. So just a quick reminder before we get started. If you enjoy our content and haven't already, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and click the bell to be notified when we go live or have a new episode recorded that you can watch. Alternatively, follow us on your preferred podcast platform. So we've got Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts. For those of you listening in live, feel free to drop your questions in the YouTube live stream chat, and we'll do our best to answer your questions during the show. So now we've got that little bit of housekeeping out of the way, we'll get into things. So Damien, I'll hand it over to you to get us started.
Yeah, sure. So we've been speaking a lot over the last few weeks about these, and months about these sort of different scenarios that are popping up, and obviously inflation's running quite hot at the moment, there's a number of people who are talking about this is, you know, it's here forever, this is here to stay, and whereas central banks are still along the lines of they don't think inflation will last, they think it's sort of transitory and will fade. And so we want to sort of explore that in detail, and there's sort of two, the one I really wanted to hit on this week was supply chains. I've got a few different scenarios that sort of looking at each one. So, at the top level in terms of the inflation side, on one side you've got that goods demand is going to remain high relative to services, and so you know all this extra demand for we've seen in terms of good that's really is pushing inflation is there to stay. Versus the inflation bust side is sort of saying, well, the goods demand is going to revert back to trend, and services is going to pick up as everything reopens. And so, that's sort of one we've spoken a lot about, where we're very much on the idea that the goods demand will revert back to trend, and it has started to, but it's still, whereas it peaked at sort of about 20% above trend, it's now closer to 10% above trend, but it is still above. The next part is the supply chain side, where you know the inflationistas have the view that a lot of these supply chain problems are intractable and they're going to last for years, and so we're going to see higher prices because supply chains just aren't as efficient as what they used to be. And the other side is that you know supply chain problems are temporary, and potentially there's even been the improvements you're getting in terms of productivity or in terms of supply chain methodologies at the moment might actually even lead to falling costs at a later stage. On the inflation boom side, you've got commodity demand going to exceed supply for the foreseeable future, and on the other side, you've sort of got what we spoke about a lot about last week and the week before about the whole China construction actually reducing the demand for commodities and with the supply chain that's coming on, you could see that flip around. Energy costs, now that's a much bigger one, but you know that on the inflation side, you know, you say that energy costs are going to remain high. They're high. You haven't had as much investment as what's needed, and so they're going to stay high. And the flip side is that Nord Stream 2 gets resolved, as and some of the issues you've been having with Russian gas is a political play rather than an economic one. And so once Nord Stream 2 sort of gets resolved and we're already seeing the Chinese measures to reduce demand take hold, that you'll see energy fall. And then finally, you've got the wage growth side. And so actually, and so we've spoken about all the above ones. The wage growth will go deeper into in a future episode. But there's two quite plausible scenarios on both sides, and it's I don't think anyone really knows the answer. We do know that quits are really high, so the number of people quitting jobs is quite high. There's a little bit of wage inflation. It's not sort of runaway wage inflation, but there's certainly some. There's a relatively plausible scenario that, in which you say, you know, wage growth continues as workers are in short supply, and they're not just working for any job. They're getting higher, and since they get higher wage rises, that'll then lead to, particularly at the lower end, that'll lead to more demand, which will then more demand for goods and more demand for services, which then sort of circles around and keeps driving inflation higher. So that's one possibility, and it's certainly one we need to be aware of and keep on track of. The alternative is that it's quite potential that workers actually don't want more pay. Like they're not working for, like when they're quitting, you know, at least anecdotally and from surveys, a lot of it is that they want the better lifestyle. So if they have workers that are saying, no, we need you in the office 5 days a week, they're saying, no, I'll go find a job where I can work 3 days a week in the office and 2 days at home or vice versa. And if that's the case, if it's more that workers do want a better lifestyle, then you might find that pays actually don't go up that much in terms of individuals getting work. Productivity is going to fall probably. You'll probably need workers. Companies will need more employees to do the same job, and so that makes productivity worse. It makes profits lower, and you don't actually get that same kicker from. If you've had people who, whatever, you've had a lawyer who's, you know, earning $200,000 a year and decided that they want to work 3 days of work from home now, and they're actually happy to take less money maybe to get somewhere that will give them that option. And so if that's the case, or the same money. And so if that's the case, then maybe what you find is that you don't get that same wage growth at the lower level, and so demand sort of remains weak. And so, you know, that's sort of our two inflation booms and inflation busts sort of scenario. I don't think, you know, while we sort of think a lot of the ones on the inflation busts are true, it doesn't necessarily have to be all of them. And vice versa on the boom side, you know, you don't need to have every single one of them has to tick the box in order to get inflation. So it's it's really a matter of trying to watch these going forward. And that's where I wanted to sort of jump into this supply chain this week. And focus on a few particular supply chains, and then maybe what we could do is, you know, certainly welcome people to throw into the comments, you know, any supply chains that they think are a bit of a bellwether for what's happening in the market.
Great, that's a great intro, and there's obviously two main scenarios there, so inflation boom and inflation bust. We'll just explore both sides of the coin for that. And yeah, so that's a good intro. And yeah, take us away and lead us off into lumber prices.
Yeah, sure. So lumber prices is, and I was actually, we were just talking just before this, I should have actually put the toilet paper one in as well, because that's probably the toilet paper, I think, is probably more of the, that's the very short term where, you know, the pandemic hit. All of a sudden, nobody could buy toilet paper for love or money. The price of a used toilet, maybe not a used, but a second, let's call it a second hand, you know, the resale value of packets of toilet paper that people did have, you know, shot through the roof.
Yeah.
It was, and then lo and behold, you know, we can produce enough toilet paper to service the nation. You know, people didn't increase the number of times they visit the bathroom too much, you know, despite all the extra food, I suppose, that, you know, it wasn't like you doubled your toilet paper use. And so the prices fell back down, the volumes fell back to normal, and you know, you're off and running again. So that's sort of like, that was extreme case. Different sectors are on different timelines. And that's the part where, you know, we really do need to be careful about saying, if we're looking at sectors that are one by one having these price spikes as shortages emerge and then are resolved, then we need to make sure that we're not looking at this inflation number that's sort of being held high by different industries at particular times, but then eventually the overall inflation, you know, at the moment you've got a lot of these doing this spike, which upward, up, but then once you hit the other side of it and they all start spiking down, And if it's just one by one they do, then you will find, you know, you might even end up with deflationary issues for some of these. So lumber prices are probably one of the I don't want to call it the bellwether, but they're certainly one of the faster ones where they sort of earlier in the cycle. So they shot up to from $300 or $400 in the prior years up to sort of $1,700 and then fallen back down. And they do seem to be bouncing a little bit at the moment. So, and prices are certainly really high relative to historical years. So it's not like this problem's gone away, but it's certainly, we're well off the highs of the recent ones from a wholesale perspective. Part of the issue is the retail prices actually haven't fallen anywhere near as much. And this is this whole part about you got basically in sort of May, June, you effectively had a panic where everyone, similar with the toilet paper, everyone had trying to clear the shelves at the local supermarket for all the toilet paper. All the builders were basically didn't want to get stuck without any lumber. And a number of them were ordering, multiples of what they needed. They were saying, well, I'm going to order for this job and my next job or I really need it for this job. And so I'll order it from three different suppliers. And if they all come through eventually, well, I'll then divert that into my next jobs. And so you got some really weird pricing things going on within that market where, you look at within the futures trading within that market, some of the spreads that you could get, basically just by buying lumber and then selling it the next month, you could sort of pick up $100 basically risk-free on the whole deal. Because this is for a commodity that usually trades at about $300 a ton. So you could basically buy a ton and make a third of what the price, just by holding it because everyone was full and nobody could take it. Everyone was looking at it going, I'd love to buy more lumber and then sell it in a month's time, but I just can't because my inventories are all full. And so, it's not clear yet. Like there's still issues going on throughout this sector. And one of the things that, one side of it's prices. The next side of it is volumes. And so the question is saying, is it true now that prices will have to stay high because nobody can produce, there's such a high demand for goods for this lumber that all this extra capex is going to need to be done and people just can't produce at the current levels. And I've got another chart coming up on the next one, which is sort of just showing so it's a bit of a mix here. It's showing railcar loadings of lumber and wood products versus housing starts. And the issue with this one is, so you can see housing starts have certainly taken off. Like they're still well below the levels that you sort of saw right throughout the early 2000s, but they're well up on the last few years. So housing starts are running along at a decent clip. The bottom line showing that lumber and wood products loadings in terms of rail cars, and you can see in that is still miles below the what it was sort of prior to in the early 2000s. It's up on what it was in the 2020, but it's not that dissimilar to 2019, and it's been coming off. And I guess this is this point I guess I'm trying to get to is that it's not the demand is not unprecedented. It's not this whole level of demand within these products that's saying, there's no possible way we can supply that much lumber. The prices are going to have to rise, 5% per annum for the next, 10 years just to get enough supply and bring that all on. It's basically going, no, it's certainly elevated demand, but they're not. It's not shockingly different from things we've seen in the past. And so it does say, to me, that says, okay, we're now talking about short-term frictions within it and issues about, COVID shutdowns and not enough truck drivers and they can sort of tick the box of a number of problems that have sort of been come out of COVID, but it doesn't seem to me to be an intractable problem that has no solution and except for, continued rises for years upon years.
Yeah, Damien, just a question here. So with lumber prices that spiked so high, there was obviously inflationary for house building. Yes. And they've now come back down. and but house starts are still sort of a little bit lower. Do you expect the, you know, that inflationary with the cost of lumber increasing, you know, the cost of building a house increased? Do you think that cost is actually going to come back down now, or do you think it will stay elevated?
Look, they've got in terms of the lumber side, I think that's pretty much done for. I think what at the sort of house builder level, those prices are still coming down. They haven't fallen as steeply as at the wholesale level, because there's all these timber yards and everyone that bought lumber at, you know, $1,100 a ton or $1,500 a ton, and are all trying to sell that back to their retail customers at the old prices before they gradually sell out that stock and then get new stock in and start selling it. So I think it's drifting, but there's other issues within that whole house building sector, and probably the big one is making sure they've got enough labor, and so that's probably the point about whether will we see deflation across the actual price of building a house. Very much dependent upon labor, which I'm not quite sure about. Do I think that we'll see deflation in the components of the costs that are going into that? Yes, I do. So the product side of building a house, I think you will see, but the service side is sort of yet to be seen, I think, in terms of that.
Okay.
So there's the lumber volumes. The other thing, I just along the same type of lines is if you just look at the sort of just the last year of production within the lumber market, so you can see that's actually been falling off. So there isn't this massive spike in production, and you can actually see that, you know, Canadian the utilization of Canadian capacity has actually fallen almost 10% in the last 2 months alone. So, or up to, you know, in the latest data that they've put out. And so the issue there is saying, well, if there's individual, you know, COVID related reasons or things like that are slowing production, but it can scale back up to prior levels and solve any sort of remaining demand issues, then you're much less worried about prices. Whereas if we saw in this one that capacity was like at the maximum capacity, you know, they're basically using every sawmill they possibly could, demand it all spiked, and they still weren't managing to keep up with it, then I'd have more concerns. Whereas, I look at these and I'm not particularly concerned about the capacity within that. Okay. So that sort of covers off on lumber. I'm not sure if there's, so the next one is shipping. And, so within the shipping prices, we've got, and I've used, actually, this is a world one. Yeah, if you look at, say, somewhere like China to, say, Shanghai to LA, it goes even higher than this, but it has started to come off in recent times. So, I guess the main thing here, I guess I'm flagging on the shipping, and we've spoken a little bit about it on prior ones, is that it's very much a traffic jam going on. So what you'd see is, have you spoken about using the road as an example for this? There's 10,000 cars an hour going through the road. All of a sudden, you know, now 12,000 cars want to go along the road per hour, and everyone crawls to a halt or calls to, you know, going 15 kilometers an hour. And that's effectively what's been happening. And the supply chains have shot up. The price per container shot up. There's been all these unintended consequences of it, in that a lot of the ships have actually been have been traveling at sort of 70% full, because last minute containers pulling out because they don't want to pay $10,000 a container to move it. And there's all these, you know, there's queues at shipyards within the US. They can't unload the packages fast enough, and there's a lot of unionization issues and not having enough workers, and so they're having problems actually just getting through the backlog in terms of the US. If you look at the next chart, we've got a sort of major delays that's just showing that the time to get from China to the US has almost doubled in terms of the last couple of years, And so that's creating, that sort of creates more problems in itself, in that you've got more ships tied up just sitting on the ocean. So, you know, the faster they can get through, the faster they can turn around. And so you, it's sort of like a bit of a pro-cyclical one where as that number starts to fall, then all of a sudden I've actually got more ships that can then turn around and transport more goods. And so that sort of delays in itself is slowing things down. And so there's actually less volume going through than in many cases the what there has been in the past. So
yes, yeah, despite this huge, sorry. So Damien, what's causing these delays? Is it the more ships, or are there other factors at play?
Look, as best as it's the goods demand is the big one. So a big demand in goods off the back of COVID. So we've had more people. So it ran at about 20% above. Goods demand ran at about 20% above trend, whereas services demands, travel and massages and haircuts and all that type of stuff were running about 20% below. Mm-hmm. Due to COVID, and I think a lot of it was just that people had money and nowhere to spend it, and so you can't spend it on services, so you spend it on goods, and that does seem to be reversing now that people can spend the money on services. That does seem to be flicking back the other way,
and you think that'll ease, like, and what, how long do you think that might take?
Yeah, it's a tough one to guess. Look, I'm assuming it's sort of going to take over the next 6 months. That will ease off. Mm-hmm. The other big factor is coming right now, and why a lot of this spike has been just in that recent months, is that spike, particularly in price, has been in this sort of August, September, October period, is Christmas demand. So, one way of describing the US in particular, which is where most of the problems are, the US supply chain issues, is that it's pretty flexible. It sort of expands every year and adds sort of 20-30% capacity with all the new ships and new goods coming in for Christmas goods mostly from China. And then it sort of shrinks back again, and people stop working overtime, and they don't run as many shifts, and they go back to sort of the normal factor. What it seems to be happening now is we've had both. We've still got the demand for goods elevated. There was a few sort of things like the Ever Given ship that got stuck, and just normal Christmas demand, and there's basically no extra spare capacity, and you've ended up piling up into a traffic jam. And part of the issue is nobody really completely understands how traffic jams do start and what causes them to finish. Like what is the actual point that starts to, is it, if it's somebody just lightly tapping the brakes and the next person taps and the next person taps and the next thing you know you got a traffic jam, there's not really a clearly identified start to it, and by the same token there's not a clearly identified end to when it finally clears up. But there's a decent chance that over the next month, I think, is probably pretty critical in terms of saying, if we're right, then you are going to see some freeing up of this, mm-hmm. continued freeing up of this, and starting to churn through these backlogs of goods is what I'd expect. If it hasn't happened by mid-December and potentially even early December, then we're going to have to rethink what our views are on the shipping and look at what the issues are.
Okay, that's a good explanation. Thanks. We've got a question here from one of the viewers, from Greg, in regards to global shipping. So, do you believe that ESG issues are likely to make an impact on global shipping, i.e., crew pay and conditions, bilge water discharge, and there's obviously a fuel component in shipping there as well?
Yeah, look, relative to the cost of the to what we're seeing, I don't think it's going to be meaningful. Look, yeah, it's probably going to have some effect on it, but typically containers go for less than $2,000 a container, and we've been currently running at 10 or more, so the running costs in terms of crew and all that type of stuff, you could probably double all their salaries and everything like that, and the container rate might only need to move up by 10-15% to cover those costs. So I don't look upon it as that making a very big difference to the overall costs. In terms of ESG side, look, potentially there's some fuel stuff that's coming up, but I guess that'll be a question about whether I think they're trying to install new standards, but if the standards can't be met, I think they'll and they thought shipping rates were going to go ballistic. I think they'll ease off or give more time in terms of standards being met. So I guess the answer is yes, a bit, but not anywhere near like what we're seeing at the moment.
Okay, yeah, I hope that answers your question, Greg.
The other one I just wanted to show as well in terms of looking at the same type of factor is in terms of shipping traffic jam. So just talking about volume. So this I've got a chart up, a world chart here of from Maersk, which is the world's biggest shipping company. And this is what they expect, or their rough guess at what shipping volumes are doing, where green is a big increase. Dark green is a big increase. Light green is a smaller increase. Yellow is roughly the same as what it was, and then orange and red for down. And as you look across that world map, it's mostly yellows. There's a few reds and a few greens on either side in different areas, but really, you're not looking at a massive increase in demand. Like there's not this. So that sort of keeps coming back to that question of saying, is this an intractable problem? Is it the fact that we can no longer ship stuff from China to the US for more than $10,000 a container? And is it true that the US ports are just so locked up that they'll actually never be able to? Not never be able to, but they're gonna have to go out and build new ports. You got to wait a few years for them to build new ports or new capacity before you'll actually get back to what you were. Or is it a matter of a mixture of extra demand from goods during coronavirus, sort of meeting the Christmas rush, and just having no spare capacity? And we're in that camp that was saying, look, we just can't see the evidence that all of a sudden goods are not only so elevated relative to past, but they're also going to keep getting more elevated or stay at this elevated level. That would actually mean that this this shipping traffic jam is going to be with us for years before it clears. And then one final one, just sort of showing that this is a one that I get very much from. There's a couple of companies we've been looking at that. In terms of, well, some of that we own and some that we've been comparing to try and work out where the top is in terms of truck companies, and just looking at tonnages. So this is where you can see. So I've got both rail car loadings and truck tonnages in the US here, and so while they're relatively high if you look at it on like a 20-year basis across this chart. If you look at it just over the last couple of years, they're actually down on where they were, and in particular, the truck tonnage is sort of showing that demand is just not as high. It is the problem. Really, is this traffic jam that's sort of slowing everything down, which is then lifting trucking rates dramatically. But actually, the volumes are it's the effect of everyone's going 15 kilometers an hour. So actually, we're doing worse. We're delivering less than what we used to at much higher costs because of these traffic jams.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting. And do you think that's that'll also ease as the supply chains ease as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is another one. We will need to. We've got the September data out at the moment, so we're going to have a couple of months before we really get into the to see where it's going. But yeah, it does look like that's another factor. I think if we don't see it over the November December data, because once you get into December, it's too late to send stuff for Christmas, especially from China. And so one end of, and we can see signs. I haven't actually got a chart here, but we can see signs that the end of the pipe coming from China isn't being shoved as full as what it used to be. And so it seems to be clearing up, the logjam at the US end still hasn't cleared up, but there are signs that they're not shoving as much down the down one end of the pipe, and so it gives the other chance at the end of the pipe a better chance to clear. That's sort of one that we'll be certainly watching closely. And I guess I suppose that's where I'm, at the start of the show, we said, look, add in stuff that you're interested in, because I'm trying to look for these sort of bellwether or canary in the coal mine type supply chain issues that we can sort of try and get on top of to go, well, will this clear or won't it clear? Are we in for higher inflation because supply chains are just stuffed for a number of years until we build new ports and new systems? Or, is it a moment of indigestion that will pass?
Yeah.
So that sort of leaves the shipping side. The semiconductors is the other big one that gets a lot of airplay in terms of. So I thought I was going to hit up on semiconductors and then hit up on the car market in particular. So I've got two charts up. And this is semiconductor prices. The first one's on a long-term sort of 40, 50-year basis, and just sort of showing that the long-term trend is down and decidedly down for semiconductors. Some of this is, or a lot of it is just improvements in the actual semiconductors, the number of chips and all that type of stuff they put on. And so, but I guess the shortages that we're really having are shortages in things that go into cars, like, and it's the simple things. It's a chip that runs your speedometer, or it's a chip that moves your car seat back and forth, or your electric windows. It's not the high end cutting edge chip stuff that's in short supply. And I guess that's where, again, it comes back to this question about you can see on the right hand chart, there's been this bounce off the bottom. For and a rise in those semiconductor prices, it's nowhere near as dramatic as obviously as what we're seeing in other sectors, but there's certainly a rise. But the real problem has been this shortage of it, and the net effect is, do I think that no one will be able to produce chips to move your car seat back and forth at the same rates that they produced them last year? Are they going to need, double, triple the prices, and are they going to need prices to keep rising over time? Or do I think this is an issue of a shortage and a confluence of demand that will again pass once it sort of flows through? And, I keep falling into that latter camp and looking at the semiconductors, I really can't see evidence that that prices are going to spike, that much higher.
Yeah, well, it seems like the long-term trend is obviously down for the cost, the price of semiconductors, and this short-term sort of spike up, is that just inflationary, or is that more the shortage, do you think?
More the shortage. Yep. And if you look at the next chart, we've got one up there of all the revenues, and so part of the issue with this as well is that this sector keeps on growing so quickly, and everyone's putting new chips in everything. And as 5G becomes more ubiquitous, there's going to be way more chips in, everything from, your robots, your robot vacuum cleaners to your fridges and all these other things that where everyone's just trying to add more and more functionality to it. And so, so certainly expected to grow and grow quite quickly. But the issues that I very much, well, the issues I put it into at the moment is more about a short term shortage, and there's been other things like a drought in Taiwan that produces a lot of the chips and problems in some of the Korean factories, and there's been a few bits where it's sort of factors that might on their own not have affected things too much, but given the tight situation, small things now can upset the apple cart, so to speak.
Sure, sure.
And throw this off. So it's the next chart I've got then is just showing quickly the capacity utilization, and I guess the important thing there is that the capacity utilization, depending on how you measure it, but it's running at sort of above 100%. So there's know, there's certainly lots and lots of demand. They do need to spend more money on R&D to expand, which they generally are doing anyway, but there's obviously a much bigger demand at the moment. So I would certainly expect that's going to occur. The thing I would note, though, about this graph is that it's very cyclical, and that's been the curse of the of this sector, the whole semiconductor sector, for you know, as long as I've been looking at the sector, is that what happens is they have these shortages, and then everyone goes out and builds new factories, and when they build new factories, they build them like they really build big ones. So it used to be that when you build a factory, you would you might build a factory to cater to, you know, I don't know, 0.1% of world demand, and there'd be 1,000 of these factories of, you know, or 10,000 of these factories around the world. What's been happening is they've been really trying to get the benefits of scale, companies, the big companies involved. And so we're seeing fewer and fewer companies involved in the manufacturing. But as they're doing it, they're creating these, you know, 10 football pitch long factories that have got all these, you know, these high tech machines and everything like that. But they're just pumping out, you know, 1 or 2% of world demand is getting pumped out from individual factories. And so it's all about scale. And so what tends to happen is there's not enough. We got this huge shortage in chips. All these guys go out and build these massive factories. And as they're building them, they go, okay, we used to make 100 million a day. Now we're going to make, you know, 200 million a day or 300 million a day. And so all this extra capacity comes on, and then prices get smashed. And then, so everybody stops, and then the demand, which is growing quite strongly, keeps chugging away. And next thing you know, that we're short on capacity again. And you can just see through this chart that's up, the capacity utilization one, is it just keeps coming back time after time. We hit that spike, falls away, hits that spike, falls away. So it might take a little bit longer. I actually think the semiconductors one that, there probably is another at least 6-12 months of time to sort of really get that to clear. But to get the clear fully, but it certainly has started to clear in some respects, which we'll get to the using the car manufacturing as an example, which is sort of the next slides up.
Yeah, Damien, just can you explain for some of the viewers what actually is capacity utilization and how that can actually go above 100%?
Yeah, so look. Capacity utilizations—it's an estimate of how many chips or how much can be produced in that particular industry, because it's an estimate, you can then get the actuals come out at above that, and also people might, you know, they've built a factory and their estimate is whatever, you know, 100 million units or whatever it is, and then you get these huge demand spikes, and they go and look at their systems, and they jig a few of their processes and try and find a few more efficiencies. The next thing they're putting out 120. So okay. it's sort of in the books at 100, but actually they can do 120 when they do all this, or they're working people more overtime than what they used to, or you know, running things to more extreme levels than what they might want to do over the longer term. So yeah.
Okay. Yep. Thanks for clarifying.
So yeah, so moving to cars. So now this is the, I guess this is where, you know, the rubber hits the road in terms of, you know, price rises. I've got here the used car prices and new car prices. And so the used car prices in the red, first over a long period of time. And so you can see sort of right through the 80s, they sort of ran up in price, but you know, for the last 30 years, that there really hasn't been a lot of price movement at all in terms of cars until the last year. And so we've had this spike up in terms of new car prices, and a lot of this has been to do with shortages. And because we've had a shortage of new cars, people then who you know, can't find a new car have been going out and buying used cars, and so used car prices have really rocketed. And there's places now where you can effectively buy a car that's a year or two old for roughly the same price as what a new car would have gone for.
I don't think that's ever happened in history. That's pretty unique.
because you just can't get hold of it. And so the question then comes back to, well, and I think there's a pretty obvious question on the used cars, is like saying, okay, well, is that sustainable? Will used cars now be more expensive than new cars, you know, if they keep going the way they're going? And I think to me the answer is, well, no. Unless you've got a permanent shortage in car manufacturing that just can't be filled. So, you know, that's a possibility, but it doesn't seem to be likely at the moment.
Just a short-term issue.
Mm. Now, new car prices are up. So there's going to be this interesting question about, can they hold on to it? So they're going to try, I bet. They've got these, you know, the car that used to sell for $30,000 is now selling for $35,000 just because of shortages. They're going to try and hold on to that $35,000 as long as they can. But if there's excess of supply coming through as all the car companies get going again, the question is, will they look at that $35,000 and say, no, I've got to keep moving that price up? So to get inflation, that's what you need. You need that $35,000 car to turn into $36,000, $37,000, $38,000 and keep going up. Or once the supply sort of all starts to hit, are they going to start actually ratcheting that price back down and competing away that in turn trying to get more volume? So if you talk to cars, the car manufacturers, they're all sort of like, oh, we're going to try and hold on to the car, these prices. We think we can, maybe we won't produce as much and we'll get better margins and all that type of stuff. That's sort of sounds like a great plan to have before the first shots get fired. But the question for me is, you know, the first month or two where their sales are down, but they've managed to hold on to their prices, you know, and they've got all this extra capacity, spare capacity coming in terms of manufacturing, will they just produce the cars and reduce their prices to try and pick up more market share? Yeah, you know, my bet is the answer is yes. And you know, it's a competitive industry. There's a lot of car makers out there. It's not sort of a cozy duopoly or something like that. There's a lot of different makers who are more than willing to undercut each other to try and get a deal. So, I guess that's the new car prices. If we look at the part of the issue as well, it comes back to inventories. So, and the sales. So I've got both these on. Put them both together just to show that, you know, we've had this part where there's usually a bit of a you rarely see that what happens is you have falling sales and falling inventories at the same time. So it's basically saying there's a bit of a lag often, but the issue at the moment is they're selling out of all their cars that they've got, but the sales volumes are actually really low. And so when sales volumes, they just don't have the fleets to sell. But actually, and it's probably more important if I flick to the next one. Unfortunately, the new car production stuff, the global sort of data is a bit delayed. But if we look at, say, Toyota, which is the world's biggest manufacturer, depending upon which day we're asking, is that you can see that they sort of would produce close to 9 million cars a year. And the 2021, this is actually the company's financial year, which finishes in March for Toyota. So they, in the year to March, they only produced 7.5 million cars. They've had some production problems for the in the last few months, but their target is to hit 9 million for this coming year. And at the moment, the release was out sort of last week or so, just saying that their expectation now is that December will be their first month where they're back to normal production levels. I think it's 800,000 cars a month, running at sort of levels above what they were in 2020 and 2019. So it does look like from the car perspective, this is fading. This looks like it's going to be become less and less of an issue. You can't say with certainty. I think there's obviously a lot of people all the way along this have been talking about supply chains clearing. And I almost think as well from talking to companies, when this first started happening, the companies were like, oh, yeah, it's all transitory. Yeah, there's a few supply chain issues. It's going to pass pretty soon. And then a month later, they were like, they're still here. And then 2 months later, they're like, oh, yeah, you know, those transitory things I thought a couple of months ago, it's looking like they're not transitory. And now, 2 or 3 months down the track, it's almost as if you've had a bunch of people go, oh no, these are going to last forever now. You know, they've lasted for 6 months. And so now this is just the new way things are. And I do think there's that tendency for people to extrapolate, you know, recent trends out forever. And whereas, you know, hopefully what we're showing today is that, you know, that what we're really seeing is completely consistent with there being a supply chain, problems in the supply chain, not in so far as that they need to dramatically increase the price to solve that issue. It's actually just an issue of just freeing up either the shipping or freeing up the people that they need to work for the some of those other inputs where there's the sort of supply chain blockages further up the chain that are then causing it. And as each one of those clears, eventually you sort of end up with normal production, and that the companies, you know, companies are adaptive things. They will certainly have learned new productivity enhancing ways to ship things. So yeah, the amount of air being shipped around at the moment is dramatically decreased in terms of boxes. So it used to be that you go, yeah, I'll have a box and I'll put something in it and I'll put a bunch of foam around it and there's all this spare air and it doesn't matter, I'll throw it in. It doesn't really make much of a difference. Whereas with all the shipping problems, you know, companies been going back and going, okay, how do I reduce the air in my boxes? You know, because if I can fit 20% more boxes onto the ships, then I don't have to worry as much about the this. And so, yeah, there's been a lot of those types of productivity enhancing measures, which once we come out the other side of it, might well mean that actually prices end up even lower than where they were before we even started this process, as all this extra people put things on.
Yeah, Damien, so that's some great insight. So with more supply coming on the markets, how long do you think that, you know, with prices of new cars and secondhand cars being elevated at the moment, how long do you think that's actually going to take to translate into lower prices or more normal sort of pre-COVID price levels?
Yeah, tough one. My guess would be within 6 months, but it's hard to tell. So I mean, I guess if we look at it this way, that so just on if you used Toyota as say the a similar thing for the rest of the industry, in that they used to produce 9 million cars, they've dropped back to 7.5. So you 1.5 million, maybe a bit less, 1.2, 1.3 million cars short. So what's that? You know, 15% fewer cars. Some of that demand's already been solved by the used car market. So, so maybe you got 10% more. So you basically need to produce enough to sort of sell that extra 10% that you missed during the period. And some of it will never be replaced, in terms of it being there's people who are like, you know, I'll replace my car every 5 years. And because there was a shortage of cars, well, this one I had to drive for 6 years and then I've replaced it. So there'll be a little bit of that, that you just sort of, it's effectively demand you never get back, I suppose. But, you know, if on that basis, if car companies could produce it, they increase their levels to, I don't know, I suppose if they've increased it by 10%, then you're probably talking 6 to 12 months, I suppose, to clear the backlog. If they can increase their production by 20%, it'll take them 3 to 6 months. Mm-hmm. So, I guess that's the sort of ballpark I'd be talking. But I think, though, it won't be a matter of having to wait that long to see. So I think what we'll find is that shipping costs, we should start seeing, if they're not falling sort of by mid-December, or falling quite dramatically, then we need to reevaluate the reasons behind that and whether there's issues. In terms of car prices, look, if you're not seeing things start to happen, so Toyota moves to full production in December, guessing a lot of other cars will sort of move to similar ones in December, January, maybe into February. You know, by March next year, you should really start to see some of those inventories starting to build again and the sales getting back to more normal levels in terms of new cars. And if that hasn't happened, then we need to sort of, again, reevaluate. Maybe there are other price pressures there that are here to stay that need to be looked at.
Sure. Yeah, that all makes sense, and we'll obviously watch that space and keep people updated as things change and progress.
Absolutely. Right. So just to sort of wrap that all up, I just wanted to, I guess, just come back to that two scenarios and just sort of keep people in mind that we're looking at this. You know, there's an inflation boom and an inflation bust scenario. We might have just throw those up on screen if we can. That sort of look at the two different options. You know, will goods demand remain high, or is it going to revert to trend? Is supply chain problems intractable, or are they temporary and going to pass? You know, is commodity demand going to keep exceeding supply, or is the Chinese construction sector falling over, you know, going to drag that commodity and actually see commodity demand falling? Energy costs, you know, high or falling back to more normal levels, and then wage growth on both sides. So there are sort of our key factors, and we'll sort of come back to each of those over the next few episodes, just to really sort of dig in a bit more deeper, and discuss what's going to drive this and where, you know, where we think we're right, but the signs we're watching to work out whether we're wrong, and certainly that supply chain ones is hopefully that's gives a color of what we're looking at.
Yeah, great. And so from what I understand, what you're saying, Damien, is you think this is a shorter term problem, and you know these supply chain issues will ease over the next sort of, you know, coming months. So what does that mean for markets and what do you know if you're right in your predictions, what do you think that means for the Australian market and the world markets?
Yeah, so the main one for the Aussie market is, well, the main one is you want to be you want to have fewer Aussie shares than international. So we've got probably twice as much international shares as what we do Australian shares at the moment. So it's taking quite an extreme view on that, because Australia is very, very driven by commodity prices. The Australian market's a sort of a supercharged version of growth in terms of the world. When world growth is going really well, then the Aussie market goes well because of commodities and growth factors, and the Aussie dollar goes up as well. So somebody investing in Australia gets this supercharged, the Aussie market either goes really, really well or it goes really badly if things are falling. On the flip side, us investing out, we actually get a little bit the opposite. So we get the currency actually helps to cushion the blow. So as we've seen over the last the last couple of months, as growth has been slowing and we're seeing more out of China, the Aussie dollar has been coming off, and so that's actually, you know, very much contributing to the growth in world equities. So that sort of just, yeah, the Aussie dollar falling, the Aussie dollar falls 2%, then your shares in US companies effectively go up by 2% to help sort of help drive that. So we're doing that. We've also taken some position in bonds, some of the longer term bonds, with the view that we do think the inflation scares sort of reaching it's close to its peak, and that if that comes off, then you'll see you will certainly see the other side of that, and you'll see that you'll see those bond yields start to fall back to more normal levels, particularly in Australia, where we think the growth dynamics are just not the same as what they are overseas. I think we've seen a lot of Australia's sort of been grouped into this similar to New Zealand and Canada, which are both seeing rising interest rates and quite hawkish central banks. But there's a number of idiosyncratic things we've dealt with on past issues that means we think the Australian market's quite different at the moment, and we're not going to follow those two economies, which is what I think is being priced into bond markets.
Okay, yeah, fantastic. Thanks for those insights. Just calling out to any viewers, if you've got any questions you want answered, this is the last chance before we do the question of the week. If you've got anything, just pop it in the chat box. And yeah, Damien, what were you about to say?
Oh, there's a couple of questions there, actually. There's some ESG ones. It's probably worth raising.
Okay. So from Andy Reid here, If ESG is pushing for less investments in fossil fuels, will this have a knock-on effect to the availability of byproducts from oil and gas?
Yes. Yes is a short answer. It's an interesting question because it's a big theme that's around. I think greenflation, and you know, there's a number of people sort of really running hard with this theme, is that it's ESG that's ruined it. And I can certainly see elements in terms of it being that US shale gas is probably the key one. So that's probably, but having said that, you know, there's still a fair bit of investment and volumes are growing quite strongly in that area. With current oil prices, they're more than willing to invest. I think there's a certain element, especially in Europe, where there's been this thing about, oh, the wind didn't blow, and so therefore we didn't get enough come through, and so therefore energy prices are really high, and it's all the wind's fault in ESG. Whereas we've put a chart up a couple of times on this on here, where we're just showing the amount of Russian gas going into Europe and how that's just dramatically fallen away over the last few months. And our view is that there's actually, you know, there's certainly some factor of the wind not blowing, but it's been, really what's been driving it is Russia mucking around with how much they're supplying, trying to force the decision on the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. So, you know, effectively standover tactics. You know, we're not giving you, you know, you haven't got as much gas as what you want. Oh, we've just built this new line that you haven't approved yet. We'd really like you to approve it. So why don't you approve that, and then we'll give you the gas you want. And so from that perspective, to me, that just accelerates the desire to move to more ESG. To more renewable energy. Is that if you've got if you're worried about high gas prices and you're worried that these prices, you know, you've got a supplier that might decide to switch off gas or reverse gas for political reasons, then you want to try and get a different something different up and running. Even in Europe, even with sort of poor solar conditions, it's a pretty similar cost in terms of solar versus gas, and so at more typical prices. So when you see gas at current levels, solar ends up being much cheaper. And solar plus batteries, depending upon where you draw the line and you know how far south you are, solar plus batteries actually becomes at high gas prices actually becomes better than gas, because, and that's our take, is that, you know, your long term outlook is that if you can derive solar or wind power and store it in batteries for, you know, a couple of days, then you've got enough, or the first step is actually just time shifting, but then you've got a couple of days after, you know, eventually get storing it for a couple of days. Then you've actually got effectively a scalable solution that you can use, and you don't need any of this. You don't need all the other fossil fuels. We're obviously not there yet, but the prices keep falling year after year, and we're actually not that far away. And if gas prices were going to be, you know, where they are now, or, you know, $30, $40, $50 or an MMBTU, then it's well worth it. Like, it's actually cheaper to buy batteries, even at today's prices, buy batteries, buy solar power, stick it in and deliver your power. So you can look at some of these high prices and say, well, you know, that is driven by ESG, and maybe there's a grain of truth in it, but I do think there's a they're sowing the seeds of their own demise if prices are going to be that high, on one side. And the second thing is, a lot of the oil demand in particular takes decades to get up and running, and the gas as well. A lot of these gas projects take, you know, maybe, yeah, certainly in, you're measuring it in a lot of years to get a gas project up, and the offshore oil is you're talking decades. You can't really complain about the ESG over the last 2 or 3 years all of a sudden causing a problem for supply. I think there's potentially something there in the shale gas, because that is a very fast supply. But the reality is, the shale gas has been pretty strong. So I think there's a grain of truth, but there's a lot of hype behind that whole ESG part to that. And oil has got a similar one. Oil's not as bad, But I think there's an element in terms of oil where if oil was, especially for people who talk about saying, oh, the oil price is going to $200 or $300 a barrel, at $200 a barrel, the cost to fill up your car, everyone will be buying electric cars because you'll be looking at an electric car going, well, that's way cheaper than a petrol powered car. At whatever it is, $80 oil, no, actually it's more. It's at the moment, unless you're driving it, I think on our numbers, about 60,000-70,000 kilometers a year, it's cheaper to have an electric car. But on a but that keeps coming down every year, and so my take would be, if you saw oil at hundreds of dollars per barrel, then all of a sudden it'll be cheaper for everyone to have an electric car than what it is to have an oil driven car. So there's very much limits there, and that's falling every year, that price that becomes more attractive.
Okay, brilliant. Thanks, Damien. That's some great insights there. And Andy, I hope that answered your question. So now we're going to move on to the question of the week. So Damien, which supply chains should we be watching?
Absolutely. So yeah, so viewer question, drop it in the comments. Yeah, we've picked a couple of ones that we're sort of keeping an eye on, but I'd love to see anyone else who's got views on what the canary in the coal mine is. You know, what is a supply chain that really will give us a feel for whether these problems are intractable and are going to last for years, or whether it's just temporary and will go the way of toilet paper, the toilet paper experience.
Yeah, time will tell. And so have you got any last insights for us, Damien?
No, happy to leave it at that. Thanks.
Okay, well, thanks for joining us today, Damien. And thanks again to everyone who's watched the episode live, and to all those that have asked questions along the way or watched the replay. We do welcome your feedback on the show, especially in regards to suggestions for future topics. So if you do have any ideas, please drop it in the YouTube comments below or send us an email at contact@nucleuswealth.com. Don't forget to click like on the video now. And finally, if you know anyone who you think might get something out of today's episode, we'd appreciate it if you share it with them. If you'd like to see more of previous episodes and webinars, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content and please check out our website at nucleuswealth.com. To stay up to date on news from us, you can also follow us on all the social medias. Thanks again for tuning in. From myself and Damien and the rest of the team, we look forward to seeing you at the next episode. Bye for now.